This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
You're listening to Femi on FUBAR Radio.
So the United Kingdom will only leave without a deal on the 29th of March if there is explicit consent in the House for that outcome.
At a national level, the Conservative Party appears to have abandoned attempts to modernise or to broaden its appeal and has become less tolerant and more inward-looking.
He needs to change the Labour Party, and there are things we need to do. I mean, firstly, we've got to eradicate anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish racism in all its forms.
Far-right founder of the English Defence League, Tommy Robinson, has been permanently banned from Facebook and Instagram for repeatedly breaking policies on hate speech, so Facebook has reported.
Comic relief is a 20-year-old formula that asks comedians to perform and sends celebrities, most often white, out to Africa. And that image evokes for lots and lots of ethnic minorities in Britain a colonial image, a white, beautiful heroine holding a black child. Comic relief is doing very little to educate its public.
Hey, it's Femi from Our Future, Our Choice. You may know me from Our Future, Our Choice because we are the group that is calling for a new referendum with the youth movement for people's vote. Now, I'm joined by Holly Thomas, who's a journalist from the New Statesman and CNN. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So how have you found this week in news?
Difficult to keep up with. There have just been so many things. I cover stuff on the US side as well, so keeping up with Westminster at the same time has been pretty ridiculous, but yeah, no, it's just been a complete mishmash from every angle.
Yeah,
I would say.
Our politics has pretty much gone to beyond chaos. I mean, in terms of Brexit, you've had Theresa May having concluded the deal in November, still saying that she wants to leave it until the 12th of March, 17 days before we actually leave the EU, before Parliament can decide what to do with a deal that it knows everybody hates. So utter chaos.
Yes, exactly. And if there's any possibility of an amendment for a second referendum, that has to be decided before the 12th of March. Mm. So people kind of have to get their house in order to decide what they want before then, which is so unlikely. Mm. So it all sort of feels like lip service, really, to that option. So.
Well, I mean, what's happening right now is the only way that they can actually deal with this is an extension, which means that you're pretty much going to end up in a situation where Parliament's going to ask for an extension. The EU is going to say an extension for what exactly? Because we've spent the past 2 years trying to negotiate mostly with ourselves before we can figure out what to negotiate with the EU. And then the only circumstances in which the EU is going to allow an extension is basically if we got a clear plan and we can't commit that we're going to actually have a deal or conclude or agree a deal in any sort of reasonable time. So for me, I actually think as a new referendum is pretty much the most likely outcome, purely because the only way you can say we know we'll have a clear outcome by a certain date is if we say, well, on this date, we'll actually have an answer from the people.
Yes, absolutely. I think the problem with basically every option is that none of them really do too much to frighten the EU, but they all kind of cut off our own nose to spite our face. Mm. So even if, you know, if, for example, we do get a second referendum, rounding up enough Tory MPs in favour of that to offset the 28 Labour MPs who have already said that they are not gonna go for it anyway because they represent Leave constituencies. God, I would really like to see another referendum. but it's just the amount of legwork that goes into every single step for every single option in such a short space of time seems sort of insurmountable in basically every direction.
Yeah, well, yeah. I mean, this was never going to be a situation where politicians as a whole would agree on one course of direction.
No.
It was always going to be, okay, this option gets ruled out, this option gets ruled out, this option gets ruled out, and eventually we'll end up with the least unpopular option.
Yeah.
And that will somehow manage to squeeze its way through. Elsewhere in the news, we've got, I mean, politics is literally crumbling before our eyes. We've got the major parties splintering off into smaller parties with the new creation of the new independent group. What do you think? What's your take on them?
TIG. Well, their name is completely hilarious. I think they're really interesting. I think the implications for Labour, especially for them to have set themselves up, they're sort of a little bit, I mean, they're more clear on anti-Semitism than they are on Brexit. Mm. And I think that at the very moment that Labour is looking so terrible on that score, it's really interesting because it kind of it factions the Labour Party even more because they're splitting their attention between what do we do on Brexit and then also can someone please take a strong stand against anti-Semitism. And then you have Tig randomly in the middle, who are now kind of looking eye to eye with the DUP in terms of their representation in Parliament, which is also kind of interesting how they'll play off against each other. And they kicked things off with a visit to Nando's, which is just the most random thing. And what I found really funny about that, there was clearly such a sort of, we're so centrist and we really get the people. And then so many people saw the photo of them at Nando's and were like, why are you buying bottled water? It's free. Like, you have no idea what you're doing. No one's got peri peri chips. Kind of chaotic, but I think that what Tig says about how the other parties are handling everything is kind of the most interesting thing about Tig.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the creation of new parties is only one, it's a step in the sort of the right direction, but it doesn't solve the main problem, which is first past the post. I mean, a new party isn't going to get the votes unless we get rid of first past the post, because in order to get any seats, you need to win outright in your constituency, and with a party that has that little funding, it's going to be an uphill battle.
Yes, exactly, and I think also it's weird because it kind of mirrors the problem that the Remain campaign had with Brexit, is that setting yourself up in opposition to something is not the same as having a clear we are for this message. And a clear we are for this message is much more effective usually in terms of the public, because it continues to be really confusing for a public who, if you're just looking casually, it's really, really difficult to get any grip on who wants what, what anyone's, what the positive messages are. Because Tig is coming at everything from an opposition. I mean, everyone's oppositional, but it's much more about we don't like this rather than we like this.
Yeah. That's the conversation we definitely need to have in terms of what do we do moving forward, not just do we like Brexit, do we like anti-Semitism? Obviously, no. But the point is that we need to have a conversation about what we actually do want. We do want to stand for as a country, and that's just not happening here because everything is so consumed with these negative feelings around the topics that are coming up. It's more negative. But this is the floor is yours. We want to hear from you. So if you want to tweet at FUBAR Radio, or tweet at me, because we're going to be talking about security this week. You can also call us on 0330-223-0200 and get involved. We want to hear from you. Also in the news this week, we also had an issue regarding Comic Relief.
Yes.
Stacey Dooley went to several places where Comic Relief had done some work to showcase basically the work that's been done over there, and basically David Lammy wasn't particularly happy with it. And the idea that it shows the white saviors as being the champions of the progression in Africa, and that was somehow racist, there was an inherent racism in that. What would be your view on that?
I would say that David Lammery is right. I think that it just demonstrates a kind of a really, really outmoded approach to these things. It sort of feels a bit Bob Geldof. It's like, that's sort of a 30-year-old approach. And as Lammy pointed out, there are so many kind of celebrities comedians or prominent people in Africa who could have done the job that Stacey Dooley did. So why was it Stacey Dooley?
Well, I mean, for me, I was in two minds when I heard this story, because on one side, the attitude that the only good things in Africa come from the West is a very harmful one, which we need to address. But at the same time, the purpose of that Comic Relief documentary was to showcase the good that is being done in order to encourage people to donate to those causes. Now, that is in and of itself a noble cause, and if it requires people to showcase that good, I think it's good to do that. But also, there's an element of lose-lose in there, and that you can't really show people how much they can help while also showing people that it's not just your help that makes Africa good. Make Africa great again.
If only we could make everywhere great again.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I mean, it is it's nuanced. I think it was just disappointing that it just felt outmoded. I think that was the real problem. Mm. It just felt like I sort of had like Green Book winning Oscars flashbacks of it's just a bit like, this is kind of what feels like a safe way to do it. Feels very sort of like, oh, this is what we've always done, so we'll just automatically do it the same way, and just a little bit more thought about how it might look.
Well, let me just take David Lammy's words. I mean, he says, my problem with British celebrities being flown out by Comic Relief to make these films is that it sends a distorted image of Africa, which perpetuates the old idea from a colonial era. Comic Relief is a 20-year-old formula that asks comedians to perform and send celebrities, most often white, out to Africa, and that image evokes a lot of ethnic evokes for lots of ethnic minorities in Britain a colonial image of white beautiful heroine holding a black child with no agency, no parent in sight, and parents in sight. I gotta say I see his point, but like I said, at the same time, you've got to say, all right, given that if you do look at towards the colonial past, you've got to recognize that there is a degree of something is owed to those countries, and so it's important that we do support those countries, but at the same time, we need to make it clear that those countries should be standing for themselves as well, and they have a lot to offer the world, and it's not just that the only good things there come from us.
Yes, exactly. It was clearly well intended. I think it was just that the execution was maybe a bit of a misfire. Like maybe a slightly better approach would have been to pair British celebrities. You know, just I can see the point of having someone with a higher profile that people in Britain would recognise and go, oh yeah, no, I like her. If she's doing that, then I'll pay attention. But maybe just sort of pairing them with sort of an equivalent person in Africa might have been a way to balance it.
That's a pretty good idea. I mean, that would have made sense. Another story would be the fact that MPs are set to get a raise.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people's raises are contingent on, you know, for example, hitting targets. Mm. And if you were to look at how MPs are performing at the moment, I think most people would find it difficult to justify, food banks are, food bank use is on the rise, social services are absolutely crippled. It's quite if you were to ask a sort of someone on the street, you know, is your MP doing an amazing job? I suspect that very few people would say, yeah, God, they're absolutely loving killing the game. Mm. Yeah. And I think also what's really, really distasteful is that civil servants who do, you know, most of the actual legwork and are much, to start with, paid, you know, a fraction of what MPs are, their pay rises are capped at 1%. So the disparity in that, it just looks really bad. It's literally a reflection of what we're saying in the wider society of the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer.
It's why you keep hearing the phrase the political class.
Yeah.
The idea that despite you've got a parliament that is devoting all of its energy to a Brexit that it knows the vast majority of its civil service have concluded will hurt the country and hurt the people they're supposed to represent, and they're devoting all of their energy into that, and you never hear a thing about the NHS, about housing, about poverty, homelessness, the democratic deficit in the voting system, all the issues that people actually care about and they desperately need to fix. Those are getting zero airtime, zero political capital, and the MPs who are pushing this Brexit train along, sucking out all the oxygen from the country, they're the ones getting a raise while people are still on food banks.
Exactly, exactly. They're effectively being paid to navel gaze. It's all about them. They're paying much more attention to the fights that they're having with each other and who is, you know, playing off power than actually doing the job of serving the people that they should.
Exactly. And speaking of MPs who are not exactly doing what I would hope they would do, Dominic Raab today on Radio 4 Today said that the EU is being dishonourable in terms of how it's using the Northern Ireland situation to force the UK to do whatever it wants. I found that to be disgusting.
I agree. This is just to be completely upfront. This is not a subject on which I would claim any expertise or close to expertise. On the face of it, yes, I agree. I think Dominic Raab calling out people's principles for it to start with is just not something he really has a right to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, again, it's literally using issues which really, really affect and are really close to people's hearts, affect real people's lives, and using it as a political football.
If you know that there are people who lost family members in the Troubles at the end of the last century, 3,600 people died, and that was put to end by a Good Friday Agreement in 1998 that we signed explicitly as EU members, and you're in charge of making us no longer be EU members, and you know that people in Northern Ireland are terrified about what that would do, and so they voted by 56% to stay in the EU, and you think that this issue is just some tool that the EU is using to dishonorably gain a degree of advantage when it's us that's deciding to put it in jeopardy. It's just ridiculous.
Exactly. It's completely inhumane. And again, just it really, really demonstrates the level of detachment of, you know, the political class. Mm. They're completely disassociated from how everything looks, and more importantly, how everything really, really affects real people. Mm. It's, again, it's navel-gazing. It's how does this work or not work for me? Not what are the actual real-life, heart-rending implications of what I'm saying.
And the idea that, let's just for people, just as a bit of background. So in Northern Ireland, there was, let's say, a disagreement of whether or not Northern Ireland should be officially part of the UK or part of a united island of Ireland. Now, that led to a lot of violence over centuries, and in the last 30 years or so of the last century, there were 3,600 deaths. Now, they came to an agreement, the Good Friday Agreement, or the Belfast Agreement, which basically says that Northern Ireland stays officially part of the UK, but there's no physical infrastructure on the border with the Republic of Ireland. So people who want it to be United of Ireland, they can see there's no physical barrier, so they feel like it's one country, but at the same time, officially, it's part of the UK. Now, if we start importing products from America, like beef, for example, which doesn't meet the EU standards, and so there's big trucks of beef in Northern Ireland which don't meet the standards of the EU, then the only way you stops massive smuggling for them to gain a commercial advantage is to check stuff at the border, which means that by leaving the EU system, we have endangered the peace process. So to say that the EU is using that in some sort of dishonorable way when it's us that is endangering a peace process that put an end to 3,600 deaths is something I can't forgive. And also, especially coming from Dominic Raab, who by his own admission didn't understand the extent to which we depend on Cali border trade, now wants to pretend like the border issues in Northern Ireland aren't an issue when he knows he hasn't got a great track record on that particular topic. Unbelievable.
it's gross. It's really gross.
Yeah. Moving forward, the Brexit, there's going to be an upcoming vote on the 12th of March. In fact, we basically when we realized just how crazy this was going to be, we actually our Future Choice, we got about 200 or so young people to fill the halls of Parliament on Wednesday, basically speaking to MPs, telling them basically give us a vote. I mean, it's the most logical thing. If the deal is toxic to Brexit voters, if no deal is too irresponsible, the only thing they can do is basically wash their hands and say, all right, we tried. You guys have a go.
Yeah. No, exactly. I think what's the average age of an MP now? It's quite old. I can't remember what it is, but it's quite old. And I think it speaks volumes of sort of how... It's a bit like the question with climate change, that they're not actually realistically going to have to deal with the fallout of the things that they're doing. As we've discussed, they make a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, it will take a while for everything to completely unravel, by which point it will be irrelevant for those people. Whereas for, you know, the young people you mentioned, this is going to impact potentially the rest of their lives.
Yeah, the average age of an MP at the general election 2017 was 50.
Right.
And that is the just above the Brexit voting age group, where people under the age of 49 as a whole voted to stay in the EU. And we're talking about the most economically active and most economically vulnerable part of society. I mean, people in the age 18 to 24, they are just starting out in careers. They're looking for stable jobs. They're looking to get a house, get on the housing market. And an economic hit is going to affect them for the rest of their life, because they just they haven't as established as people who are like 50, who have their jobs secured, who have been working for their pension. They're the ones who are protected, and they're endangering us.
Exactly. And every measure that sort of that MPs kind of claim is useful for young people, it's like, oh, we're going to build loads more houses. Mm. We don't need loads more houses. There are loads of houses that are standing empty. Mm. That the work, you know, the value of which has just been pushed up so much by inflation. And these new houses that are being built all cost, you know, the affordable homes are usually it's approaching £500,000. And what young person on, you know, potentially 0 hours contract, earning minimum wage, just a bit more, even double, triple, four times the minimum wage, is going to be able to afford that? Like, they do not have any idea what it's like for young people.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
in the UK today.
Well, I mean, we clearly do need to build houses, but as you said, actually affordable housing.
Yeah.
Because I mean, and for me, the main issue is, because we're so centralized around London, because the industry comes here, it pushes the prices up here, and so houses don't get built elsewhere because the industry isn't there to support that. And so if they actually built houses and built industries in those areas outside of London, in the places that have been forgotten, places largely that voted for Brexit, then the country has a hell of a lot more chance of actually succeeding, which for me is the biggest issue. Also, Chris Wilmington. So he went, then he came back, and then he went, and then he came back, and he was fired. What exactly happened?
I really couldn't tell you. I mean, you sort of wonder how on earth it got to this stage. It's a bit like Ken Livingstone. Like, how many times did he have to say Hitler and Zionism before he was eventually suspended? And I think it was Margaret Hodge who pointed out earlier this week that Chris Williamson has real form for this. You know, this is by no means the first time that he's expressed anti-Semitic views, and the fact that there was even a pause before he was suspended again, like, really, really gave so much. It just handed power to Tig. Sorry. Yeah. Again. You know, the one thing that one thing that they have come out really, really firmly against is anti-Semitism. And it's just astonishing that when there is so much going on for the Labour Party and everything is just so precarious, and there is such an obvious anti-Semitism problem, which again, it's like complete detachment. Do you not realise how offensive this is to such a huge proportion of the population? It's so, so wrong. And they just to dither before suspending him, it's just mad. I don't understand.
Well, I mean, at least you've got people like Tom Watson who are standing up and taking a stand, which is good. So it's a problem that exists, but I'm hoping that at least with the pressure that's on now, maybe they'll be moving in the right direction soon.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, and also people at Jess Phillips have been pretty vocal about it. But I think it's a case of Corbyn supporting his mates. Like, he comes on really firmly on anti-Semitism unless he's a fan of them. And Chris Williamson has championed Corbyn and has kind of booed any, you know, critics of him. He's been a supporter, and so he got leeway, and it's just a really, really wrong way to run a party.
Well, I mean, yeah, we just have to. The racism that exists in Parliament is something that needs to be dealt with immediately. Yeah. You've got Boris Johnson, who talks about pickaninnies with watermelon smiles. You've got Anne-Marie Morris,
letterboxes.
Calling them letterboxes. You've got Anne-Marie Morris talking about the nigger in the woodpile, or what is it, something like that.
And that
wasn't even the first time. There was another Tory MP who had said that a couple of years prior. So it's apparently just standard Tory lingo.
Exactly, and it's one of those things again that, like, it only seems like it's really being picked up on now because it's become such an open topic publicly. It's external pressure that is making people kind of, you know, some MPs sit up and sort of push for improvement on this, because clearly this has been, you know, this is a really endemic problem that's been going on for years and years and years. And it's only because you know, there's just been a bit more publicity around it now that they're sort of thinking, oh God, I suppose we should, because, you know, people won't vote for us otherwise. Mm. The motivation, again, is just completely wrong and completely self-serving. It's just wrong. That's it. That's why you should not tolerate it.
Well, Holly Thomas, thank you very much. I mean, racism is it's clearly an issue that, I mean, you've got people rising up like Tommy Robinson, which is absolutely ridiculous, and he's getting more and more fame. I mean, today, fortunately, Facebook has decided to ban him, but he's taken that as being, he's now playing the victim. Holly Thomas, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having
me. Let's listen to Tommy Robinson trying to claim that he's somehow the victim here.
We knew it was coming. The whole world now has seen. Within 24 hours of us releasing Panodrama online, Panodrama, a documentary that categorically proved with evidence the establishment working with the media, working with far left George Soros funded organisations to destroy the people speaking against them. The proof and evidence was there. Within 24 hours, we had 1.5 million online views. By now, that would have been 10 million. And within 24 hours, I'm completely deleted from the internet. The censorship is real. We've got them rattled. They fear us. They genuinely fear it. They fear a movement that's growing. Now, the message is simple. When they raided my house 3 times in the first 6 months of the English Defence League, they thought that would stop me. It didn't. When they put me in prison and locked me in a room and had me nearly beaten to death, they thought that would stop me. It didn't. When they took away my Twitter, they thought it would stop me. It didn't. They took away my PayPal. That nearly stopped me. 70% of the donations disappeared. We've just produced the most powerful documentary anyone's seen from us. It didn't stop us. Will banning us from Instagram and Facebook stop me? No, it won't. It's come earlier than we thought. So now we need to fight back. We're already making plans. We've already made plans. We're looking at the possibility of a massive demonstration in London against the censorship, with figures coming over from America. People are being censored everywhere. This isn't about Tommy Robinson. This is about anyone who opposes mass migration. Anyone who speaks out about Islam is being censored across the world. It goes against the globalist agenda. Today, they've banned my book. They're literally burning books. That's what they're doing. You can go on Amazon and buy Mein Kampf, Hitler's book. You can no longer buy Muhammad's Quran, Why Muslims Kill for Islam. This is the way our society is heading.
Oh, poor Tommy. Poor Tommy. He's such a delicate little flower. I'm joined in the studio by Elizabeth Braw from the Royal United Services Institute for Defence and Security Studies. I'm joined by Andre Walker, who is a Brexit supporter, was involved in the formation of Breitbart in the UK.
I was, yes.
Yes. Azad Ali from Cage UK.
Hi.
Pleasure to meet you all. So we're going to be discussing security issues today. But I mean, first, about Tommy Robinson, I mean, his narrative around Islam, and he believes that all people from that particular faith are somehow pose a threat. If you could say one thing to Tommy Robinson, Azad, what would it be?
You're a symptom, not the cause. I think it's important to, whilst Tommy Robinson, he's a petty criminal. He's been in and out of prison. It's important not to give him airtime and focus. What we need to look at is actually the structures that have given the voice to him. Because if you look at some of the things he's saying, it's nothing different from what politicians are saying. It's nothing different from policies that are coming in place. So the issue of Islamophobia and the way Muslims are being treated in the UK is a structural problem, not just what you know these ranters are saying on the street.
Yeah, I mean, I would thoroughly agree. I mean, we saw... The topic was touched upon in when Liam Neeson had his little thing with black people, when he said that he basically wanted to go out and kill a black person because of what one black person had done.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's that idea that you tarnish an entire race because you've looked at.
Yeah.
But I mean, the symptom of that, and this was actually it was Trevor Noah that pointed this out on his show. He said that. If the only time you see a black person is on a police camera on TV or as a gangster in a movie, if the only time you see a Muslim is when it's on the news and it's related to terrorism, then that is your experience of that particular demographic, and that will create a system whereby people like Tommy Robinson will be able to go on air and say, "Well, this is all you know of them."
This is something that's proven academically as well. One of the reports, a huge report that Lancaster University did on studies of media bias, what they found is for every 21 stories that were written about Muslims, only one of them was positive. And even that positive story about the Muslim was positive because the Muslim they were portraying wasn't really following Islam. Mm. So they were also socially engineering what form of Islam is acceptable. Mm. So this demonization, this othering of Muslims, whether it's Muslim women being otherized as submissive, you know, they don't have their own thoughts and their own minds, they don't make their choices, or young people, you know, vulnerable to radicalization and everything else. And Muslim men, they're always violent. You know, every time you see or hear a story about a Muslim man, they're always portrayed as being violent, you know, savages. They don't have, you know, a thought process and things like that. So this takes a toll.
And Andre, how do you feel about the narrative around Islamophobia and how Muslims are treated in the media?
Well, I think that there's no doubt that there is a concern about it. I, funnily enough, I actually agree with the view on Tommy Robinson that he's a symptom. And I always think one of the great things, or the sad things about Tommy Robinson, is how it all started with, I think it was the Luton Defence League or whatever it was. The Anglian Regiment comes back to Luton and loads of people are there to cheer them on. Amjam Chowdhury and probably about four people go to shout abuse and say they're baby killers and whatever. And obviously, mounting a protest that is clearly illegal in terms of the abuse that he's shouting and the harassment. Of course, what Robinson's angry about is not the Muslim community, it's the police's failure to take action against Anjam Chowdhury. I suspect if you were to turn around, the police on that occasion, of course, said, well, the Muslims would be offended if we stopped them protesting. I suspect if you'd gone to the mosque and asked them whether they thought it was appropriate for people to hurl abuse at the Anglian Regiment, pretty much 100% of the people you spoke to would have objected to it. So I think time and time again, we see that the police and the authorities make significant mistakes and then blame the Muslims. And I'll give you a really good example. If you look at victims of crime, there are two ways that you increase the number of victims. You either have a larger number of perpetrators or a larger amount of time for them to perpetrate. If police and social services decide that they will not arrest a Muslim paedophile at all in Rotherham, then those guys are going to have more victims by definition. It doesn't mean there's more Muslim paedophiles. The reason there's more victims is because there has been a policing policy that would inevitably create more victims. But then what really annoyed me about Rotherham was this. Then these people turned round and said, we did it for the Muslims. Well, hang on a second. I didn't see the mosque or the imam or anyone from the Muslim community demanding that these people never be arrested. What has happened is a group of liberal white apologists has run this ridiculous strategy and then landed the Muslims in it and blamed them for it, which I think is absolutely disgusting.
So would you say that Tommy Robinson isn't actually Islamophobic in any way?
Well, whether he is somebody who's genuinely racist and genuinely hate-filled, I'm not sure about. Mm. I think his problem is, and certainly where UKIP comes along, the idea that you would have somebody who's a convicted criminal effectively on the board of your political party. I think the fundamental point is, the issue here is community relations. The issue here is not the fact that one person is gobbing off. You know, if community relations were better, if there wasn't issues, like I've just laid out with Rotherham, if there wasn't the issue over the Anjam Chowdhury thing at the Anglian Regiment, and you hear loads of other examples, then somebody like Tommy Robinson becomes irrelevant. I always get the sense from Tommy Robinson that if he could, he'd just go back to his sunbed shop and never be heard from again. But, I mean, by the way, that's a good piece of knowledge, isn't it, that he owns a sunbed shop and that's his business.
But I mean, I would say that his views have been a little suspect. I mean, for example, I mean, there's this compilation that was made of things that he said.
It's not a refugee crisis, it's an invasion of Europe by military aid Muslim men. What they're doing now in our country is raping their way through it. Taking a Syrian refugee, I hope you don't get raped.
Let's not pretend we're important people from Iceland. We're not. We're important barbarians.
Because you walk in London, I walk around London, I think, where are the men? Where are the English people? It's not an English city anymore anyway. His country, his capital. It's not your country or your capital. You're part of an invasion into our country, Sadiq.
So that, I mean, just to slightly disagree with Andre there, I mean, he is a racist and Islamophobe. There is no two ways about it. And I think, I mean, these kind of things prove it, that he is. And, you know, I didn't want to underplay that, you know, he's not a racist or an Islamophobia. What I wanted to overplay and bring focus on. And especially for this is something a lot of young people actually do pick up, that they see the hypocrisy. So you had recently a Tory MP saying, oh, we've got no Islamophobia in our party. Why? Because we've got Sajid Javid as a Home Secretary. It's like, oh, I've got a black friend. You know, that kind of attitude. Yeah. It's nonsensical. The Muslim Council of Britain actually documented evidence of Tory party Islamophobia. Baroness Warsi, who used to be the leader of the Tory party, the chairwoman of the Tory party, left saying, you know, Islamophobia is rife in her party and everything else. So, you know, this denial by establishment types, And you know, we need to look at how these guys are always constantly getting away with it, and the focus somehow always goes onto these, you know, street level.
Isn't Sajid Javid a victim of Islamophobia from the Muslim community as well? The number of times I've heard I appeared on a television program where they were ranting on and on about the fact that he drinks alcohol, and as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's like, oh, he's not done this for the Muslims, he's not done that, you know, all the guy is.
That doesn't make people Islamophobic against him. What people might be doing is pointing out that, you know, if he's saying he's a Muslim, he's not practicing it very well, you know.
Since you asked earlier what we would tell Tommy Robinson if we had a chance to give him a piece of advice, I think time and again, if you don't interact with the other side, you will demonize them. And I mean, just look at Trump. So for months he called Kim Jong Un little rocket man, and then they met and they sort of discovered, oh, actually we are quite good friends. We could get along. And it's like that within any given Western country. I think we have all these tensions because communities don't interact a lot. We live in stovepiped communities often. I mean, there is obviously interaction, but there should clearly be more.
We don't talk enough. We don't talk enough. And that is what you see in this whole war on terror thing. If you look at what Bush mentioned and Rumsfeld mentioned, you know, he mentioned crusade and everything. This whole phrase, war on terror, if you just look at it, the way we've seen it, experienced it, this interventionist, you know, white savior complex that, you know, going out there, we have destruction across the world. You know, Afghanistan is destroyed, Iraq, all of this is based on nonsense. I think, Rusi, you guys actually did a study. The UK, for me, actually spent over £30 billion in Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, with that money, like, we could have employed 5,000 nurses for all of their career. We could have actually had for 10 years free tuition for all higher education, except we wasted money in Afghanistan, which is, according to Rusi, strategic failure.
The war on terror, remember, started when Al-Qaeda attacked the Americans in a way that was absolutely despicable. Right. The truth of the matter is, you can't, as a sensible country...
But the reaction was even more despicable.
You can't, as a sensible country, effectively, guys based in Afghanistan attacked the United States of America on September the 11th. The Americans had to respond. Right. The stupid thing that they did was this idea of nation building. They cleared out the terrorists in Afghanistan relatively quickly. And the reason that they effectively lost the Afghan campaign, you're probably a better expert on it than me, the reason that they lost is because the objective changed. They said, well, we're not clearing out the terrorists anymore. We're now nation building. And I think that's where they got into the
Elizabeth, what's your view in terms of how America in general and the West responded to 9/11 in terms of the war on terror since 2001?
Well,
I know it's a broad topic, but yeah.
Come back to me in an hour. So the Afghanistan invasion, I think, it was a clear response to 9/11. And of course, Iraq is a completely different matter. Why did Iraq have to be invaded? And I was a journalist at the time, living in Washington, actually during the 9/11 attacks as well. And I remember clearly, just before the invasion of Iraq, sitting at the Iraqi National Committee in Washington to interview somebody there, and Ahmad Shalabi walked by. And this is a man who convinced America that it would be a good idea to invade Iraq, and that they would be, Americans would be welcomed as liberators, and that Iraqis only wanted Saddam to go, only wanted a regime change. And then, lo and behold, it turned out to be quite different. Mm. But this is the tragedy of the so-called war on terror, that the U.S. in Iraq specifically, they went in thinking that completely false premises, not, I think, through any malice of their own, but just maybe through naivete.
I would say malice, because if you look at the evidence Colin Powell and others actually produced for the war on terror, all of that was actually brought in through torture, which was later, even the CIA and America itself admits the information was unreliable, because we actually tortured Ibn al-Sheikh.
And it was unreliable because the sources had lied.
Exactly. But this is the point that I'm trying to make, that, you know, the response, yes, you know, there has been a terrorist incident, there needs to be a response, but the response also needs to be something that is within, you know, our civilized standards, within international law. This kind of, you know, and it's not just been Afghanistan, it's not just been Iraq, it's been Somalia, it's been Libya, it's been Syria, it's been so many countries that have been, I mean, if you can go back to the colonial time, you know, and see, I mean, even take a small 50 years ago, a small island, Chagos Island, was actually colonized by the UK. The residents were kicked out, turned into an air base where actually Abdul Hakim al-Belhaj was flown from as well, who was tortured, which the British government apologized for. All of these things, you just think about it, what's going on here. There isn't, so we need to actually, one of the things we say is like, look, you know, we need to actually go back and look at the rule of law, look at responses, and things need to be handled in a proportionate manner.
For me, one of the things that often, the moment you say the argument that I'm about to make, you get labelled as, oh, well, you're siding with the terrorists. No, I'm saying, explain how we get to where we get to. Mm. We set in during the period from September 2015 to I think March 2016, we sold $6.8 billion in weapons to Saudi Arabia, which they used to commit war crimes in Yemen, killing 2,800 civilians in an area that is primarily Sunni, and we bombed hospitals and schools. Well, say we bombed weapons that were made in the UK were used to bomb hospitals and schools, and it was so bad that they bombed a hospital that was run by Doctors Without Borders. Doctors Without Borders contacted the Saudis, said, please, these are our coordinates, this is where we are, please don't bomb us. Saudis basically said, yeah, we know where you are, and then they bombed them two more times. Now, in that period, David Cameron went to one of the factories that built the weapons that were going to Saudi Arabia to commit these atrocities and praised the industry. And I'm just thinking, imagine if you live in Yemen, and your child went to a school that was bombed by a weapon that was made in the UK, and then the next thing you've got ISIS recruitment agents come knocking. I mean, the UK literally built the weapons that killed your son. This is not helping our national security at all.
Absolutely.
Well, this is the tragedy of this whole situation we are in. So, obviously, weapons manufacturers create jobs, and they're seen as a national, strategic national industry. And that's why, for example, the French government promotes French arms manufacturers so vigorously, you know, essentially acting as their salesman abroad. Mm. And yes, I mean, it's good for France, but is it good for anybody else? And so this all then plays a huge role when, you know, we Europeans, EU, well, the UK is about to leave, but the EU talks about integrating defence industries and so forth. Well, then you have to agree on, you know, are we going to export to certain countries? Are
exactly.
we not? Mm. And Germany has very strict rules, but actually it's quite interesting. So they say we don't export to any countries where the weapons will be used in another country. But then it turns out, actually, it's not really quite like that. So So the rules actually
are... You hit the nail on the head. It's a business. I mean, that's what it is. War is a business, and that is exactly what's taking place here. I mean, just take Iraq, completely destroyed. Obama actually admitted the unintended consequences of what America did in Iraq was ISIS, and that's what ISIS came out of. But if you look at Iraq, it's a country that has been totally destroyed using American and British kind of war technology. Now, there's two things. One, Iraqis have to pay for all the weapons that were used to destroy their buildings. Second, the Iraqis have to pay for in UK and US companies to rebuild all the houses and buildings and everything else that were destroyed with those weapons. So the Iraqis not only get bombed, killed and totally displaced, economically they suffer like three times on this as well. So this is, you know, nobody is talking about these things and nobody is actually highlighting this. And this pretense of, you know, we're out there to do promote democracy, we're out there to do people's human rights and everything else. It's a pretext for business.
Well, and people and decision makers and the general public may well have believed it. I mean, we all want democracy for everybody, right? But then, so I think that the misperception or fallacy or mistake or error was that we forgot that actually Saddam Hussein and even Colonel Gaddafi was the very unpalatable but still effective people who essentially kept their countries together in a very, very fashion.
It's hypocrisy. Look at Egypt, Sisi. He actually carried out a coup against a democratically elected president of Egypt. And who's now in bed with Egypt? America is, UK is, everyone is. This is the hypocrisy. I mean, a lot of people, they see through that. But where they're frustrated is that, you know, the people in power, the people in position, the politicians that are supposed to actually be there doing our bidding, you know, rather than telling us what to do, are, you know, kind of using it just to make more money. Look at Tony Blair, how much money. I mean, a guy is a war criminal, okay? Look how much money he's made since he's left the office. It's sickening.
One thing that I'd say in terms of questionable motivations, skewing foreign military intervention in a way that perhaps logic doesn't say it should go, is actually a quote from Family Guy, because which I'm going to play for you now.
Ground zero. So this is where this is
basically just them outside where the two towers fell.
Ground zero. So this is where the first guy got AIDS.
Peter, this is the site of the 9/11 terrorist attacks.
Oh, so Saddam Hussein did this?
No.
The Iraqi army?
No.
Some guys from Iraq?
No.
That one lady who visited Iraq that one time?
No, Peter, Iraq had nothing to do with this. It was a bunch of Saudi Arabians, Lebanese, and Egyptians financed by a Saudi Arabian guy living in Afghanistan and sheltered by Pakistanis.
So you're saying we need to invade Iran?
Yeah.
There you go.
One topic that's been in the news recently has been a girl called Shamima Begum. Yes. I can imagine that there, well, as in any room, there are going to be some wildly different views as to how we should treat her. So I'm going to start with Elizabeth. What is your take?
My daughter asked last night, who is this jihadi bride? I tried to explain, and it was very difficult. When you try to teach teenagers lessons, you say, if you do this, then you will face the consequences. Mm. And so this is sort of where we are with her. But I think the reality, as we've already discussed, is that if you treat people with aggression, then you just escalate the situation further. And I know I'll be contradicted here, but what is so unreasonable about bringing her back and putting her in front of a UK court? And that will teach teenagers a lesson that, yeah, it doesn't matter whether you escape or what you do. We have a legal system that will take care of you. We don't extract revenge. We don't act in haste. You get due process, but you also pay the price for your illegal actions.
So you think she should be brought here and tried?
Yeah.
Okay. Andre?
Well, I think there's a victim here that we always forget, which is the baby. Bear in mind, at the moment it's being brought up by a terrorist in a refugee camp where two of its siblings died of malnutrition. So I think that whilst I have no interest whatsoever in Shamima Begum in terms of rescuing her, and I think it's right that she is not rescued from the camp, I think it is also right that the baby is rescued from the camp. And I think if that takes... And I know this is a shocking thing to say, but if that takes limited military action, I don't have a problem with that, because I think that we need to stand up for that principle. And frankly, and look,
which
I know you can.
Which principle is that?
The principle
invading
is
a camp. To
the principle is that the baby is a British national that deserves our support.
So is Shamima there?
No. But the difference between Shamima and the baby is this: Shamima chose to be there. The baby did not choose to be there.
And
if Shamima Begum,
hang on a second.
If Shamima Begum, so let's be honest with you, she's going to beat Sajid Javid in court, isn't she? About removing the British citizenship, but she's got a big hurdle to get through. First of all, there is no consular support for British nationals in that area. If she can make it to a consulate in Turkey, then she is able to take some action. Before then, she's got a problem. What I'm saying is the baby should be transported by us. What she then does is entirely up to her.
So you think we should send in the British Army to fetch the baby?
To fetch the baby from the mother's arms, simply
snatch
because
the baby. This is the kidnaping and rendition of the baby. The baby is innocent.
Before we get on to how the British military is going to go into a foreign camp and steal a baby from mother's arms, let's just go into the background of the situation. Shamima Begum, at the age of 15, contacted people online who basically got her to go over to leave the country and become a child bride of a terrorist. Now, she was 15 at the time, which means that at that time, and under the UK law, which we're supposed to represent and respect, She was not legally capable of giving consent to that marriage, or anything that happened at the time of being 15. Since then, she's mothered three children, two of whom died. And the question is, given that she was the wife of a terrorist, given that she has shown no remorse, should she be allowed to come back to the UK?
Femi, hang on a second. She is a terrorist, and let me explain why. In this country, the definition of a terrorist is somebody who supports or joins a terrorist organisation. Age 15 in Bethnal Green, she joined the Islamic State terror group. That makes her, by definition, a terrorist.
The only problem with that, Andre, is the Metropolitan Police knew about her intention to go.
Yep.
If she had broken a law, they should have arrested her.
Hang on a second. Yeah. I think this is an important point. There has been a failure to prosecute Islamic State terrorists. That doesn't mean it's legal to be an Islamic State terrorist.
So let me make my point. First of all, that is a huge failure. I think, look, what the Shamima Begum case, and we'll talk about her in a minute, what it highlights is this structural, what I mentioned before, racism and kind of the duplicity approach. Let me make my point, Andre. You can come back.
Goodness me, I can't
believe you're defending her. We also have, and obviously we do not advocate citizenship removable at all, but we also have a white guy, Jack Letts, who also joined ISIS. He actually joined as a fighter. Okay, she is not a fighter. He actually joined as a fighter. Yet the UK has not stripped him of his citizenship, and this has been going on for a number of years. What's the difference between Shamima Begum and Jack Letts?
I'll tell you the difference.
Let me finish my point.
He's in prison, and so he's not going to come back to the UK. Refugee camp's not a prison. He is in jail in Kurdistan.
It's the same thing. The Kurds are saying the same thing.
You are trying to pretend the difference is she's Asian and he's white. The difference is he's in prison and therefore can't come back.
Let's bring in Elizabeth.
So the difference is that you can strip somebody of their citizenship if they have another citizenship. So I think the UK government is arguing that she could get Bangladeshi citizenship.
Which the Bangladesh government said no.
That's right. And
Jack Letts has Canadian citizenship.
Yeah.
Yes,
but he's not coming back. He's in prison in Kurdistan. You can shut this down.
Look,
he's probably
going to
get the death penalty. Yes, but you're accusing people of racism when there is no basis for that claim whatsoever.
Absolutely.
You know, you shouldn't lie to the listeners.
I'm not lying.
You know the reason that Jack Letts is not coming back is he's in jail.
Let me give you my proof.
There's
been about 150 cases of people who've had their citizenship removed. Mm. Okay, out of the 100, the Home Office is still not publishing all the data. From the cases that we deal with and from the information we have, apart from one person, every single one of those people are people of colour, whether it's to do with people in the Windrush scandal or other things. Mm. And majority of them are Muslims. This is the fact at the moment. Mm. Let the Home Office actually disprove that. We've challenged the Home Office to publish the data and disprove it. So
if
the second thing
Muslim
is, if we look at how the Shamima Begum story is being portrayed, I mean, just recently we saw how a shooting range actually used their face as a target, right? Now, this is the level of dehumanization that has taken place. I agree with one thing that was said by Andre and others is that, look, what does a responsible civilized society do that believes in the rule of law? It never disowns its citizen. It brings its citizen back and says, puts them in a court and says, this is the evidence against you, okay? And if you're found guilty, this is the consequences that you deal with. We don't do is say, oh, it's somebody else's problem. What we don't do is go in a camp and with the army, snatch her baby from her arms and just say, you know, good luck to you.
Okay. Can I just make this point, Femi? I think it's an important point. Look, Shamima Begum wants to return to the UK because her terrorist organisation has been defeated. That is the reason. She is not remorseful in any way whatsoever. Now, I think the point about Bangladesh is this. Look, she is as much of a scrounger as she is a terrorist. She just wants a taxpayer teat to suckle from. And Bangladesh won't stick her on the social in the same way the UK will. And the reason why that's important is this. You give a Bengali citizenship and she will never go there. So it's not Bangladesh's
you
problem.
You can't give her Bengali citizenship.
Okay, first thing I'd say is that none of the points that you made, are, all of them go towards her being a horrible person. None of them say that her legal status has changed. Elizabeth.
So I was just going to bring up the case of Denmark, the example of Denmark, which has had a disproportionate number of foreign fighters, and then those foreign fighters have returned. So Denmark early on said, okay, let's make sure they don't engage in any similar behavior again. Let's make sure that we don't foster that culture among others. Mm. And so they essentially rewarded them with...
We've also had UK people return as well from Syria.
Yeah, but so the Danish
Almost
model was really...
Let's just hear from...
Was really interesting. They gave them flats, jobs, social support workers and so forth. And then others in Denmark were saying, well, hang on, I'm waiting for a flat and they get that. So it's so difficult to know what the right thing is because really, if you extract revenge, you get even more of this sort of thing.
Just to move on to a couple of other topics quickly. Russia is testing a internet kill switch where they're basically going to shut off the internet for a bit just basically to try what would happen in the event of losing internet. Also, there's issue. I mean, you've talked about how you don't believe that the 2% spending on it for NATO is wise. Why is that?
So we're talking about. Specifically about Germany. So NATO has this benchmark where all member states have to spend 2% of GDP on defense, and several countries do, the UK, the US, very importantly, Poland, Estonia, and Greece spends 2%, but for completely different reasons because it competes with Turkey. So the big question is Germany, which is currently at about 1.2%, and so Trump, as you know, keeps saying to Germany, you have to spend more, otherwise the U.S. won't be helping you. And Germans are just very uneasy about more defense spending. The wider public, they are uneasy about essentially anything that their armed forces do. But of course, if you're a member of an alliance and you've signed up to a particular, to the obligations of that alliance, then you should fulfill them.
Do you think it should be more? Do you think it should be less? Do you think that the notion of a target doesn't make sense?
Well, I don't think it makes very much sense, but it's the easiest way in which you can get all members to essentially do the same thing. So it's completely ridiculous because 2% in Estonia is something completely different from 2% in the US. But it's a very blunt tool, but it's the easiest tool. The best tool, to my mind, would be output. It's a measure for output. So this is what your country should be able to do. And then, you know, countries could spend 10% or 1% as long as they got that done. It's just very hard to implement.
Yeah, it's an arbitrary random thing which doesn't really actually achieve the target. My final question would be, this is for all of you, let's do one at a time. What would be the one thing that the country should do to improve its security? Andre first.
What we should do to improve our security. Yeah. I don't know. I think we do pretty well, actually. So I don't have any major personal concerns about it. I think there's obviously issues related to the European leaving the EU, which I think is specific kind of to Northern Ireland. But I think if we get through that, look, you know, we can argue all day about people like Shamina Begum and whatever. The number of people who engaged in terrorism in the UK is pretty low. And I think the likelihood of me being a victim of terrorism anytime soon, I think, is also very, very low indeed. So I don't have too many concerns.
Cool. Okay, Elizabeth?
I think everybody should learn first aid training in school or through their workplace. Because if we look at the sort of security incidents we have, it's usually traffic accidents, weather-related accidents, so storms, floods, and so forth. And most of us have no idea what to do. And that can be very incapacitating for communities. For example, you know, the British Army often has to go out to Somerset to pile sandbags. So what if all of us... as part of going to school, going to university, working, if we could all earn this sort of first aid or first response certificate, and then we'd be able to help in case of any emergency.
Always be prepared. Excellent.
Yeah, I do agree with what the other two have said. I think what we have to, though, realise is we haven't made our country safer in the last 10 to 20 years with the raft of legislation that's come in. We've securitised our health industry. We've securitised our primary school teachers. I mean, everything is true. We actually, as citizens of this country, are losing more of our privacy rights. And this is the big brother thing that's happening. So I think, you know, look, all these foreign interventions and everything else needs to be looked at properly. Mm. We need to actually have an ethical foreign policy, as I think his name was Robin Cook said, you know, before he passed away. This is what's needed. We need to look at what is it we're doing in other countries, like the example you gave, is that making people hate us over here.
Okay, that's a very, very good answer. I mean, also in terms of being prepared, the idea that we should all have a degree of first aid training, although perhaps making everybody prepared isn't quite going as far as, I imagine it goes quite as far as Donald Trump would go, that you should arm teachers.
There should be no weapons involved.
Can I just defend arming teachers?
We are then, but I mean, he did say the phrase, schools, there's no weapon, schools are gun-free zones that makes some very dangerous places,
which I find to be. If you can't ban guns, absolutely. You've got to arm people.
Well, you can ban guns because it's what we've done in the UK.
Not in America.
But guys, obviously, this is a very, very interesting topic where there are very wildly differing views, which has made this very, very fun for me. This has been The Floor Is Yours. It will be available on Spotify. We will see you again next week. Thank you very much for listening.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.